Moss Cohen, welcome to Radio Times. Diane Ravitch has been going through what she describes as an intellectual crisis for the last few years. A well-known supporter of school testing, teacher accountability, and school choice, Ravitch has since had a very public change of heart. She writes in her new book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, that these strategies that are central to No Child Left Behind are not working. The Obama administration just unveiled their blueprint for the nation's school system by retaining some of the features of No Child Left Behind. It calls for raising standards, focusing on the worst performing schools, and developing better teacher evaluations. We asked Diane Ravitch to join us today in Radio Times to talk about her about face and about what programs and policies lead to learning in the classroom. Diane Ravitch is a professor of education at New York University, and nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you, Marty. I love NPR.
Well, we're happy to we're happy that you say that.
And well, it's the only place to have an intelligent discussion of ideas, so I'm happy to be with you.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate that. I do want to get to the subtitle of your book, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, but let's begin with No Child Left Behind. You call it a failure. How come?
It's a failure on every count. First of all, it has really distorted education. It's turned, and I have heard literally from hundreds of teachers since my book came out, but that's not the basis of my critique, because the critique was written before I heard from all those teachers. It has turned the schools into test prep organizations in which instruction gives way to preparing kids to take state tests. Once the state tests are over, the kids feel they have no motivation to do anything because the tests really are all that matter, and they're all that count, and it's just testing basic skills. So what has happened has been that other things that are really important, like history and literature and geography and foreign languages, the arts, science, all of this gets pushed aside because there's so much emphasis and so much riding only on the reading and math test, and that's for grades 3 through 8. Some kids are just not getting an education. They're getting nothing but learning how to take tests, and they're not even learning. They're not even getting the skills that all of this emphasis is placed on.
So when you hear or when we hear about schools that have been able to raise test scores, and there's some in Philadelphia, there's some in states across the country, should we be suspicious of those scores?
Well, I'd take it with a grain of salt. First of all, because the state tests, in many cases, and I don't know if it's true in Pennsylvania, but it's true in many states, the state tests have been so dumbed down that it's meaningless. And either they were dumbed down or the state education department in some places that I'm aware of, like Illinois and New York, literally lowered the passing mark so to make it easier to say that kids are making progress. In New York State, a seventh grader is considered proficient if they get 44% of the questions right.
Well, wow.
You know, most people would say 44% was a failing mark, but it's considered proficient now. And I think that unless you're aware of, and as no one is, of all the technicalities of testing, we're getting a lot of good news that turns out to be phony. In effect, what we have going on today is a lot of institutionalized fraud. What we have not seen is any big gains on the national testing, which is done by a federal agency called NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. There, the gains registered before No Child Left Behind were actually larger than since it. So I don't see much to celebrate in terms of, you know, you won't have an anecdote about a school, one school. But if you look across the district, if you look across states, we're seeing very, very meager progress indeed.
And do you blame that on state education departments? Do you blame that on No Child Left Behind itself? The dumbing down?
No Child Left Behind, because No Child Left Behind set a very unrealistic goal. It said that by the year 2014, 100% of all students would be proficient in reading and math, and if they were not proficient or are very much on the road to proficiency, then the schools would suffer penalties leading up to the closing of the school and turning the school over to private management or turning it into a charter or giving it a, you know, closing the school down and firing everyone in it. So given all these draconian penalties, it created an incentive to cheat, an incentive to game the system, and an incentive to lie about progress. So I don't believe any of the test scores other than the national test scores, because I think there's too much incentive for cheating.
So looking at data and test scores, then you're saying forget these statewide tests, focus on these national test scores?
I think that, in my view, I was on the National Testing Board for 7 years, and in my view, these are the only reliable scores we have at this point. The state scores, they vary tremendously from state to state. and a child could be proficient in one state and cross the border and take that state test, and he or she would not be proficient, and vice versa. So I don't see that the state scores are something that we can hang our hat on. And in any event, what's happened is we've created a culture where we've forgotten that the purpose of education is to get an education, and now we have as the purpose of education getting higher test scores and basic skills.
That
in itself is the corruption that I'm talking about.
No, I hear you. But is it important, though, to evaluate how children are learning and achieving in the classroom, that we need some kind of data to try to figure out whether schools are working or not?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I say in the book that I'm not opposed to testing. I think that testing can provide useful information, and it should be used for diagnostic purposes. The purpose of testing should be, how are students doing? How are schools doing? Are we making progress? Are there programs that we're using that are working or not working? But this information should be used to support and to help and to improve. Instead, it's being used to punish, and I think that's a ridiculous use of testing, and it's a misuse of testing. And the word accountability now means whose head is going to roll.
Right.
Who should we punish? Should we punish the teacher? Should we close the school? It's a very punitive atmosphere, and it is having a very, very corrosive effect on the whole teaching profession.
Let me quote something from Newsweek, and actually their title story is "Why Can't We Get Rid of Failing Teachers?" But it looks at this Central Falls High School in Rhode Island that's gotten a lot of press about half. And I'm quoting here: half the students drop out of school. The proficiency in math measured by state exams stands at a pitiful 7% among 11th graders. Under state pressure, the local superintendent tried to improve scores by requiring teachers to work 25 minutes longer each day, eat lunch with the students once a week, and agree to be evaluated by a third party. The teachers, who according to this article make about $75,000 a year, said that they wanted to be paid extra for this, and the school district has turned around and fired the teachers. I'm curious about both what at least on the surface looks like is happening at this particular high school, and how as a country we should deal with failing high schools.
The Newsweek article was a disgrace to journalism. It was a disgrace to Newsweek. The Newsweek article could have been taken out of Human Events or the National Review or the most right-wing publication you can think of. What the Newsweek article said as its solution was we should get rid of teachers' unions and we should get rid of public education. It was an outrageous distortion of everything that I know about education. And since the Newsweek had a copy of my book in hand disproving everything that they were saying and the arguments they were making, it was just outrageous to me that they published an article that was so unbelievably hostile to teachers and treating the teachers' unions as being the big problem in American education. If we could only get rid of them and turn over all of our schools to private entrepreneurs, we would be the best in the world. That is all ridiculous, and I point-by-point counter that in my book. First of all, the highest-performing state in the United States is Massachusetts. Massachusetts is 100% union. The highest-performing nation in the world on international tests is Finland, which is 100% union. Now, I have put out to the bloggers on the right a challenge, and I said, given these facts, can you identify a district or a state that has it's either non-union or that has very weak unions that is high-performing? They have yet to produce that district or that state. So I think that the whole premise of the Newsweek article was ridiculous. I don't know all the facts of the Central Falls situation, but I think it is wrong to close an entire school based on test scores. If there's a problem, then the superintendent has responsibility to go in and find out why the kids are scoring at 7%. The statewide average, by the way, is 28%. Rhode Island has a terrible, terrible problem with math achievement. That community happens to be the poorest city. It's 19,000 people, the poorest in all of Rhode Island. They have a lot of transient children and families. Apparently migrant workers are kids for whom English is a second or a third language. There are a lot of issues there, and it's not just teacher quality, but I'm sure that the art teacher had nothing to do with the math scores. I'm sure the phys ed teacher had nothing to do with the math scores. Even the custodian was dismissed. I just think that's ridiculous. Why do we have banks that are too big to fail, but schools that have to be closed when the test scores are not good enough without any investigation or any effort to support them and help them?
Another part of education that you critique is this choice, or I guess charter schools. Philadelphia, other communities are experimenting with choice and public schools, in a sense, in competition with some of these charter schools. What's your critique of that?
Well, my critique is that basically, I had been a strong supporter of charters because I thought it presented an opportunity to do something different. Maybe it would be a change for the better. Over time, I saw so many issues arising with the charters, primarily that they tend to cream students off. They skim off the best-performing students in the poorest communities. They take disproportionately small numbers of kids with limited English proficiency, immigrant children, homeless children, and small proportions of kids with special ed. And consequently, they overburden the public schools because the neighboring public school then has a disproportionately large number of the hardest-to-educate children. And then after they have, in effect, skimmed off the highest-performing kids, they turn around and say, look, our test scores are better than yours. The problem behind all of this is that the charters were originally intended to be R&D laboratories to help and support public education. And the basic idea back in 1988 when they were first dreamed up was that they would make public education better because public teachers could go into these charters, come up with solutions to problems, come back and say, here's a better way to teach this subject, here's a better way to motivate the kids who are unmotivated. Instead, they have become privatized, and they are hostile to teachers' unions, and it's not that teachers' unions themselves are necessary, but they have become, in effect, captured by the private sector, and they now see themselves poised to take the place of public education. I don't think we should get rid of public education in America. I think it's a very important and valuable institution, and since the market sector has its ups and its downs, and it has its winners and its losers, and since the market brought us the financial debacle of 2008, I don't think that deregulation is going to make our public schools better. It's not that we need more regulation. We need better public schools. And what we're doing by focusing so much energy on this sector that now has 3 to 5% of the kids is we're neglecting the system that encompasses 95% of the kids. I think that's a huge mistake for our nation.
And I want to pick up on that. We're about a minute away from our first break here. But is the word choice a misnomer? Because I think parents feel as if with choice, they get to select the school that they want their child to go to. But it seems in practice, it's the schools who choose the students.
You have just hit upon what is a very serious issue, which is it's the schools doing the choosing. And in many, I live in New York City where there are 100 charter schools, and there are lots and lots of schools of choice. And the kids go from school to school finding a place that will take them. And very often in some neighborhoods, they may want to go to the school across the street and find out, you lost the lottery, go find some other school to go to. So the concept of the neighborhood school is slowly but surely being wiped out. I think that's a huge mistake.
And that's Diane Ravitch, our guest today on Radio Time. She's a professor of education at New York University. In her new book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, has caused quite a stir. For years, she was a supporter of school standards, school choice, the free market's role in education. She has changed her mind on some of these issues, and that's what we're talking about today on Radio Times. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener offers a full or part-time flexible MBA degree program taught by a team of full-time faculty and industry executives. Information at widener.edu.
I'm Krista Tippett. Please join me on Tuesday, April 27th at the Kimmel Center for the Performing Arts. We'll explore Einstein's God and the fascinating interplay of questions, if not answers, that is emerging between 21st century science, medicine, theology, and philosophy. Call 215-893-1999 or visit whyy.org/member experience to get your tickets for this evening of ideas on April 27th. I'd love to see you there.
Next time in Studio 360, the Chieftains are the quintessential Irish band. So what are they doing in Mexico?
I stumbled on the story about the San Patricio, and I said, gosh, that's something that I've got to try and work on.
That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Support for WHYY is provided by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. PSEA, the power of a great education.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with education historian and researcher Diane Ravitch, and for years she supported the growth of charter schools and the system of accountability under No Child Left Behind. However, over time she has become disillusioned with these education reform strategies. She's now a leading critic, arguing that testing in charter schools have disrupted communities, dumbed down schools, and produced poorly educated citizens. And that's what she writes about in her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System. And we've got calls, not surprisingly, coming into 1-888-477-9499. Diane Ravitch, you write that back in the 1990s, there was a new thinking that saw the public school system as obsolete because it was controlled by the government. And there seems to be, at least today, a very anti-government feeling across the land. And I wonder, even as a historian, has there always been a suspicion about public education and the role of government in public education?
Well, actually, I think we're in a new period, and I've studied the growth and development of American public education over throughout its history, which is from the early 19th century, 1830s, and I would say that there have always been these periodic crises where people complain about the schools, want to change the schools, but the critics over the years, and I'm speaking especially about the 20th century, have always said, we want better teachers, we want better educated teachers, we want higher standards, we want strong curriculum. Until the current era, we have never had a strong public voice saying we want an end to public education. Mm-hmm. This is new. And I have heard this. I was associated with the Hoover Institution in California, and very often at meetings there would always be people who were saying, well, you know, the problem is that the government runs schools. If we could just get the government out of the schools, and there's a kind of a free market philosophy that says that the government, whatever the government does is bad, and whatever the free market does has got to be better. And this has never, ever been applied to public education. So this is something new in the history of education in the United States. Criticism is not new. Getting rid of public education is new.
Well, we've been talking about No Child Left Behind, and it seems with every administration, or almost every administration, we get a new education policy. The Obama administration has talked about this race to the top, and they are retaining some of the features of No Child Left Behind, but they are also instituting, at least according to this blueprint, some changes. And from what you know about what the Obama administration is doing, what is your reaction so far?
Well, I think the race to the top is horrible. I wish that no state had joined it, and I know the reason they did jump in was because there was so much money. I mean, they had $4.3 billion on the table, and the deal was that in order to qualify to get the money, you had to remove any barrier to expanding charter schools, which meant more privatization of public schools, and you had to be willing to create a data system that would make it possible to evaluate teachers based on test scores. And as I demonstrate in Chapter 9 of my book, this is a fallacious way to evaluate teachers. It should be one factor among many, but not the dominant factor. And they also require that states commit themselves to turn around or close low-performing schools, which is very problematic because there is no template for turning around low-performing schools. It can be done, but the federal government doesn't have a template, and neither does the Gates Foundation. So it's problematic to say if you don't do it, we're going to penalize you. But in effect, they have bribed the states to commit to policies that they just happen to like, but which have no basis in research, nor have they ever gotten any demonstrations that, you know, that charter schools are better than regular public schools. You'll find some that are, but you'll find many that are not.
Well, then,
I don't like the race to the top. The changes are very complex. But fundamentally, they have retained the template of No Child Left Behind. Everybody will still have to be tested in reading and math, only now there will be this kind of competition not to fall into the bottom 5%, because the bottom 5%, which is about 5,000 schools, will be set to be closed. And closed and restructured, probably have the entire staff fired as they did in Central Falls, and very likely be turned into charter schools. So there is the same kind of No Child Left Behind a market mentality of let's privatize, let's incentivize, let's have competition. None of this stuff has ever worked to improve schools.
But what has worked? And I mean, we've done, I can't tell you how many programs about education, mm-hmm. and We talked to researchers, we talked to philosophers, we talked to teachers, we talked to parents, we've even talked to students about education.
Right.
And from your vantage point as a historian and as a researher, and I think we can all agree that, that there are problems with our school
sure.
system in this country.
I have been probably the leading critic of American education throughout my career.
Exactly.
So I kind of get annoyed when people say, oh, you're just defending the status quo, which I'm not. I want something much better than what any of these market mentality people want. I want a much better school system because all they have in mind is privatizing it, turning it over to hedge fund managers, philanthropists, entrepreneurs, people who see a way to pay themselves a salary of $400,000 a year while running teeny tiny little charter schools. I think we need better education, and we need a quantum leap in the quality of education. And the only way we're going to get it is by having education become more professional, not less professional. We need superintendents who know something about education, not lawyers and businessmen who know how to rearrange the organization chart. We need principals who are themselves master teachers, who know how to go into a classroom and help a struggling teacher, or identify the other great teachers who can help struggling teachers. We need teachers with experience and not newcomers who come and go every 2 to 3 years. That's not the direction we're heading in. We're heading in a direction of deprofessionalizing education. We need a coherent curriculum that includes not just reading and math, has that as a foundation, but includes beginning in the early grades history and geography and civics and the arts and science. We need teachers who are very well educated and who know how to teach their subjects. This is a template for the reform of education. The other thing we need is we need to have kids come to school healthy and ready to learn. We have many children growing up in dire poverty and who come to school ill and who have a parent who's incarcerated and another parent who is very sick with AIDS or something else. These are not conditions conducive to learning. If there were one thing that would improve educational achievement at a stroke, it would be to reduce poverty.
Mm. Well, I mean, it's hard enough to reform education.
Right.
And
I understand that, but I'm just saying let us get real mm-hmm. about what the sources of low achievement are. One of them is that kids come to school and they're not ready to learn and they're unwilling to learn, and we then load the teachers up with responsibilities for which they're not prepared, and we have laws saying that you have to have disruptive children in your classroom, and if you remove them, you're violating the law. How can you have a class that functions well? How can you say that you're going to have good education? And this is one of the things that charter schools do is they just kick those kids out.
Mm.
So, therefore, all these kids end up in a regular public school classroom where they cannot be removed, and it makes it very hard to have an educational system that's functional.
There's a program called KIPP. There are a couple of KIPP schools in Philly. I believe it got mm-hmm. its start in Texas, and it has been used in
Houston and the Bronx.
And in, yes, exactly. Use in cities, communities across the country. What's your critique of KIPP?
I think that KIPP does a very good job, but you have to understand what KIPP's limitations are. First of all, one of the outside evaluations that I think is very significant was done in the Bay Area, where there are several KIPP schools. They found that KIPP gets great results, but they have a very high attrition rate, that of the kids who start KIPP in fifth grade, by the end of eighth grade, 60% of the kids are gone, and most of them are the low performers.
Mm.
That means that, and they don't replace the kids that leave, so they have, by the end of eighth grade, a rather selective group. 40 out of 100 kids remain, and the other 60 who have either left or been counseled out are back in public schools, dragging down the scores of the local public schools. The other thing about KIPP, which is similar to other charter schools, is they rely on a steady infusion of very young people who are willing to work 50 or 60-hour work weeks. Most of these young kids, needless to say, are single because it's hard to have that kind of a schedule and have family obligations. So it's not a sustainable model for American public education. It's sustainable when you're running 82 schools, as KIPP is, across the nation. They could probably even manage to run 182 schools, but we have 100,000 schools in America. So I think that while KIPP offers some valuable lessons about discipline and structure, it tells us nothing about curriculum or about, or even about a sustainable model, since we're not ever going to reach a point where there will be huge numbers of teachers prepared to work a 60-hour work week.
And that's Diane Ravitch, our guest today on Radio Time. She's a professor of education at New York University, and her new book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, has gotten a fair amount of buzz and press, and she joins us today on Radio Time to talk about what's wrong with our school system and what she thinks can improve it. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. And you have a number of targets in this book, including people like Bill and Melinda Gates, who have invested billions, I think, in trying to improve the country's school system. What's your critique of them?
Well, the problem with the Gates Foundation is that it's so big and it has so many billions and billions of dollars. The last time I looked, it was worth had $30 billion, and then Warren Buffett pledged them his fortune, and so before the financial collapse, they were set to be $60 billion. Well, maybe they're only $50 billion now, but they have a lot of money, and they have ideas. They get big ideas. So their big idea in the late 90s or around 2000 was we need to break up high schools into small schools. So with $2 billion, they affected something like 2,500 schools. They broke up lots and lots of large high schools into small schools. And then in 2008 or so, they called together like 100 or 200 leading educators and said, we have a new direction. We decided the small schools thing didn't work out. We're dropping that. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks a lot. You know, a lot of schools were taken apart, and the small schools, some places worked, some places didn't work. But the end result was there was no improvement. The kids in the big schools were doing just as well and, in fact, better than the kids in the small schools. Now they have another thing. Their new thing is charter schools, replicating charter schools, and also evaluating teachers by test scores and having longer hours. So they have, this is now the agenda of the U.S. Department of Education because the Gates people and the Department of Education have become almost interchangeable.
What about the way public schools are funded in this country, based in large part on property taxes? And as we know, if you live in a wealthier area, you have a bigger tax base and you can spend more per pupil. In poor areas, Philadelphia is a good example, spending a lot less than in the suburbs. Again, from your perspective, how much does money matter?
Well, I think money matters a lot. It also matters a lot how it's spent. And resources have to be spent right and not squandered, and I guess there are places that do squander them, but I think that getting good education costs money, and to say that as many people do, and especially people who are very conservative, I think one of the reasons that conservatives have said money doesn't count is because they don't want to spend it. They want to say that, you know, you can find a quick fix if you just privatize, or you can have a quick fix if you test and test and test, because testing is cheaper than actually hiring better prepared teachers. But I think it matters a lot that there's inequality in funding. I don't think there should be. I think actually more money should be spent on the kids who have the highest needs because they're the most expensive to educate. And one of the things I think the federal government ought to be doing is what its original mission is in education, and that is leveling the playing field. Mm-hmm. And the whole focus of federal funding originally, and I'm going back to 1965, was to add money to poor districts that couldn't afford to educate kids well. And since these are the kids with the greatest needs, that's the right federal role. Obama administration is now saying that they want to change to not abandon what's called formula grants, where poor districts get their a share of the federal funding, but they want to add competition to those grants, meaning that if you get higher test scores, you get more money. And I think that's unfair. I do think that there should be a basic foundation for every child in this country, so that they too can have equal educational opportunity. And having more competition based on test scores is just going to, again, narrow the education available to the poorest kids, who should not be restricted only to basic skills.
Let me get some callers in the conversation. We have Joe calling us from Cherry Hill. And, Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. Diane. I teach in a charter school in Philadelphia, and I agree with your points about charter schools having problems. I've worked in a charter school for about 5 years now, and we don't have the resources. We don't have enough books. We're still formulating our curriculum. We have the struggling learners that come from poverty and don't have the resources to teach them because all the same issues are there, and we really don't teach any different than the traditional schools, which I've also worked in.
Right.
So you don't see much difference, or you see, sounds like, Joe, from your perspective, you see less resources to educate children at this particular charter school?
Oh, we're always struggling with resources. We don't have the same things that the students in the school district have, but we're still required to teach, all the same things.
Right.
It would be great if we had a library, which we don't. And then the other extracurricular stuff, too, there just isn't the money or the facilities for those types of things.
I appreciate your comment, because I think that what I've found and what I report on in my book is that charter schools on the whole don't produce greater achievement than regular public schools, and sometimes it's because they're struggling with the same kids, sometimes it's because they have fewer resources, and there are some charter schools that get excellent results, and there are some charter schools that are worse than the regular public school. On average, charter schools don't get different results from regular public schools. But what concerns me, and it's in part because I've seen what's happening now here in New York City, is that some of the politically connected clans, families that have big political ties, are moving into the charter sector because they see a steady stream of government funding that they can tap into. Some of the charter management groups are paying themselves at the top very exorbitant salaries. I'm talking about salaries of $300,000, $400,000 a year for one person overseeing charter schools of 1,000 children, not even being a principal. I'm not talking about an educator, but just the person who's, like the superintendent, although it's not an educator. So I think that charter schools have promise, but I think they have a lot of problems. And what concerns me is the idea of undermining public education to do something that's not going to produce better results.
And, Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I hear and understand your critique of charter schools, but also looking where most of children in this country go to school, which is are the public school system. And obviously there are some excellent public school systems, and one is, we know, are pretty inferior. And I wonder, too, whether there may not be a lot of money being made in it, but nonetheless, whether there is bureaucracy and politics and all the kinds of things that can really undermine a school system.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's bureaucracy and politics and everything, including in the charter school world. It seems to be something that's native to any organization. But the bottom line here is that if charter schools don't produce better results on average, then it's not going to give us the quantum leap we need in improving our schools. And this is what I've seen across the country.
And again, about a minute away from our second break here, and there has been a call for national standards. This came from a governor's organization. And Diane Ravitch, I'm curious about what you make of that.
Well, I've been a proponent of national standards. When I worked in the first Bush administration back in 91, 92, and while I was there, I was a strong proponent of voluntary national standards, not mandatory, voluntary national standards. And the agency that I worked in the Department of Education, gave out grants to professional education groups to develop standards in the arts, in science, in history, in geography, in civics, and so on. And so it's troubled me that this current effort is focused only on reading and math. It's the same old, it's like NCLB has captured everyone's brain and sucked it out. But I have not commented on the standards themselves, because I think standards are just words on paper. The only thing that makes them real is being tried out in practice. And what I've recommended to people in the administration is that they should do some demonstrations. They should give a state $5 million, $10 million, whatever it takes, and say, implement the standards. Let the rest of the country see that they're better. And then if they're better, other people will want to do them too. They should in no sense be mandatory. The president should not say you can't get federal funding unless you adopt these standards.
And we'll be right back.
Clear Mobile Internet supports WHYY. Clear's 4G WiMAX network covering Philadelphia is designed to allow users to stream TV, movies, or public radio all over town. Clear, now covering Philadelphia. Details at clear.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Lewis, the author of Liar's Poker, Moneyball, and The Blind Side, talks about his new book, The Big Short. It's about the people who made a fortune when the financial system collapsed because they bet against subprime mortgage derivatives and the financial institutions that sold them. Join us for the next Fresh Air. This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young from Public Radio's daytime news magazine, Here and Now. We bring you the news that happens between the morning headlines and the afternoon wrap-up, plus conversations with authors and music makers, stories that affect you, maybe a story about you. So please join us for Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, Here and Now. Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY FX, presenting the new drama series, Justified. Timothy Oliphant stars as U.S. Marshal Raylan Givens. Justified begins tonight at 10 on FX. More information at fxnetworks.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Diane Ravitch, and for many years she was a leading supporter of school choice, testing, and accountability. She was a supporter of No Child Left Behind, but that was then, this is now. She's gone public with her criticisms of the current system. She's issued a passionate plea to reinvest in public education, which she says is critical to democracy, and that's what she writes about in her new book called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice are Undermining Education, and she's a professor of education at New York University. Let me get back to our callers, and we've got, it looks like, John from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. And John, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yeah, great program.
Thank you.
My question for your guest is, Teach for America has an interesting critique of the problems of education, being that teachers are now taught in teaching colleges how to teach instead of being grounded in their fields. And that Teach for America says if we have people who really know their material, then we can give them a few months training and then continual backup and support. And they end up being a lot more effective teachers. What's happening is we're turning out generations of teachers who don't really know their material, but who go to get these degrees in teaching, in quotes, which doesn't really, you know, prepare them for the material they actually have to teach the kids.
John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Diane Ravitch to respond.
Sure. This is something I've written about for many, many years. I have been a strong proponent of the idea that teachers should have an undergraduate degree in a subject, a strong minor in another subject, so that they're prepared to teach two subjects and teach it well. And then they need professional training to go into a classroom and know how to handle the kids, know how to do classroom management, and also understand the strategies about how to get their ideas across to the kids. Both are needed. If you have only one, only the methods and not the subject, you're not a good teacher. If you have the subject and you don't know how to teach it, you're also not a good teacher. The problem with Teach for America is, while I think it's a worthy organization and I commend the young people who join it, it is not a way to improve American education as a system, because they bring a few thousand young people into the system once a year who stay for two or three or maybe 4 years and are gone. They have 17,000 alumni. They bring in 4,000 or 5,000, maybe 7,000 a year. There are 4 million teachers in America. If anyone can explain to me how 4,000 additions a year or 5,000 additions a year who stay for two or three years is going to change the teaching profession, I still don't understand the numbers. It's not going to change American education. And I have had many emails from Teach for America alumni who say to me, I had to leave the classroom because I didn't know how to handle the class. I got no support, my training was inadequate, and I was completely baffled. I got thrown into the trenches of a very tough school, and the kids ran circles around me. So I think that in many cases you have young people who would have liked to make a career of teaching, but who got burnt out in their first or second year in Teach for America.
John, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Diane Ravitch, you also have some suspicion of these so-called superstar teachers, and these are, I guess, the teachers that get a lot of press. They sometimes have movies and books written about them. But I wonder whether, you know, if there's a way to take or even almost bottle what it is to be a good teacher and try to figure out how to share that information so that more teachers can perform better in the classroom.
Well, you know, I think that what every school needs is to have master teachers who are available and have the time and the incentive to help the young teachers who come in. Most of the young teachers will say that they feel inadequately prepared. They get into the classroom, and every account that you read of somebody who spent a year in the classroom is a story of just trying to figure out how to deal with the kids. The kids, in many cases, are out of control. They come from homes where no one ever disciplines them. And, you know, part of the discussion that we haven't even gotten to is the role of the family in education. And this is, I think, the great mistake that the Obama administration is making and that the Bush administration before it made, which is to say that the teacher is somehow solely responsible for everything, and yet we have a generation of children who spend 7.5 hours a day, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 7.5 hours a day sitting in front of a blinking screen, either their cell phone or their video game or their television or whatever, and who have families where no one ever says to them, do your homework, here's a quiet place to study, turn off the television. Mm-hmm. All of those things affect achievement as well. So, we need great teachers, but there is, the problem with this notion of best practice is that it can be bottled and put into a video,
yes,
that it can be bottled and put into a book, is that we end up enshrining what's best for somebody but not for everybody. There are all kinds of different teaching styles at work and not just one.
Well, the president has told families, turn off the television, spend time reading to your children. I mean, it may not be incorporated in policy so much, but it seems to me...
Yeah, but in the policy, he's saying that teachers will solely be held responsible, mm-hmm, and that test scores are solely a function of what the teacher does. The Obama administration has swallowed a line of argument that's coming from statisticians and economists who never set foot in a classroom. The teachers are solely responsible for the test scores of the students, and if the test scores don't go up, then they're bad teachers. They're not taking into account that there are a lot of things that go into raising test scores and a lot of things that go into not raising test scores, and it's not solely the teacher's fault or credit. I have a chapter about that in my book, Chapter 9, about the research on teacher effectiveness and how flawed it is.
How do you hold parents responsible in a way that, and I realize you're a critic of how we hold teachers responsible, but if we're going to try to improve education and parents have such an important role to play, how do we involve them in the system?
I think that should be something that happens at every school. I think that school people have to engage parents and continually. Well, of course, what they'll tell you is that when there's parent night, and this is true particularly in the schools that are called failing schools, it's usually the school isn't failing, but they're working in an area where parents are not engaged with the school. It's like, we have a policy now that would be like going to every police force and saying, we're going to close you down if you don't eliminate 100% of all the crime in your neighborhood. And some neighborhoods are going to have high crime no matter how good or how bad their police force is. I just think it requires a little bit more sophisticated analysis and recognizing that test scores are affected by many things and not just the teacher. And I'm not trying to say that teachers should evade accountability, but teachers should not have 100% of the accountability for test scores. I think that students have a lot to do with test scores as well, including whether students are responsible, whether they're motivated, whether they show up every day. And it would be the rare teacher who could corral every student and make sure that they attend class every day. And that's, attendance is often the most critical determinant of achievement.
Let me get to Michelle from, looks like, Freehold, New Jersey to join our conversation. And Michelle, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi there. Thank you so much for the show. It's been very interesting. And I just wanted to ask about what Ms. Ravitch was just talking about. It's been my experience. I have two young children. I'm the product of public schools, and I went to a great college, and I'm a doctor now. But the schools that I have been involved with as a youth minister in my neighborhoods, in my churches and things like that, the administration and the teachers manifestly don't want parent participation. My public school didn't have any use for what my parents had to say about my education. And my worry is that by not holding teachers accountable and administrators accountable, that there's no way to have anybody be accountable, because you're saying, well, the parents have to be accountable, but when parents try and take initiative and responsibility within the school, not just at home, they're rebuffed, and we're not professional educators, and so we are not given
let me get back to your kids there.
Okay.
We can hear in the background, but your point, no, it's
nap time, but
it's fine. It's fine.
If you could address that, I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Fair enough. And Diane Ravitch, this is one example, but here's a parent who just felt she was not welcomed in her kid's school.
Well, I think that's a mistake on the part of the school. But I think that what I'm hearing in her comment and what I hear from the Obama administration is, someone has to be held accountable. And what they mean by accountable is who should be punished. And the more we punish teachers, the more we close schools, the less likely we are to get good people to come into teaching. We will have a steady infusion of the young college graduates who come and go. We will have a less professional profession. And we will not, this is not what the high performing, if we look around the world at places like Japan and Finland, this is not how they're getting the very positive results they're getting. They're having teachers who are respected, teachers who are treated with great esteem. It's very competitive to get into the teaching profession. And we're saying to the experienced teachers, we're going to chop your head off if your scores don't go up. All we want you to do is administer tests of reading and math. We want you to spend the first 3 to 6 months of your year prepping kids for the state test. And if they don't ever learn any history or literature or do anything else, that's okay with us. No arts. Forget about that. That's not tested. We're ruining our schools all for the sake of test scores. And we're not getting higher achievement. We may get higher test scores, but we're going to get worse education. And that's the dilemma we have today.
Do you think there is interest in the kinds of reforms and changes that you're talking about? And Diane Ravitch, I mean, what makes you and your point of view so interesting is that you have been a supporter of testing and choice. You have changed your mind about that. And I'm just curious whether what you were saying is resonating beyond your world in New York City.
Well, yeah, I think so. I know that it is because, you know, when I wrote this book, I thought it was going to be important, but, you know, everybody said, big deal, book about education. It's had a huge national impact. I'm getting emails from parents and school board members and teachers all over the country. I'm talking about the West Coast and Seattle and Arizona and South Carolina and Florida and Maine and on, and people are contacting me from everywhere saying, we have a crisis in our community. Can you come here? Can you come here? And, you know, it's what I've discovered is that there is this dominant narrative about education that says education has failed. We tried everything. It failed. We have to privatize it, turn it over to the private sector. We have to break it apart. We have to have competition. It has to be just like the business world. And out there are lots of people who think that none of that's true. Mm-hmm. Out there are a lot of people who say, well, we like our public schools. We want to make them better. We don't want to destroy them. So I find that my book has provided a counter-narrative, which may explain why it's sold out everywhere. It's very hard to find a copy of it these days. Amazon's been sold out for almost since the day that it came out. But I do think that people feel that they want a more positive vision of education and not just dismantle public education and turn it over to the guys who are well-intended but who are amateurs or who are philanthropists or who are hedge fund managers.
Have you heard from the Obama administration?
Well, I have spoken to the secretary. I spoke to him last fall, and actually I've seen some aspects to the new blueprint that reflected some of our conversation. I may be flattering myself to think that, but I think that the bow to the fact that there are other subjects that count. Of course, their idea is if you want to test history, go ahead and test history. We'll count that too. But I don't think that we should say the only way you get arts in the curriculum is if you test it. I think we have to have a change of mind or vision where we say, this is what a good education is. A good education includes a broad range of subjects and experiences and activities. Well-educated teachers are really important, and we don't judge them just by test scores in reading and math. And we're not going to allow our vision of education to turn into a testing system. And that's not what the best countries do, and we shouldn't do it either.
Let me get Ethel. Michelle, thanks for the call. Ethel from Overbrook to join us on Radio Times. Hey, Ethel, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
I passed the teacher's exam in Philadelphia, and I taught in North Philly, and I was completely unprepared for what I encountered. So I actually had to give up my license, and I first became a substitute teacher, thinking that would give me a little more control over where I go. And we had to go get orientation, this Philadelphia orientation, and the person in the orientation classroom told us exactly this: make believe you're going into Vietnam.
That was
the orientation for the substitute teachers in North Philadelphia.
Well, Ethel,
but I want to just say one thing.
Okay.
If the kids love the media so much, and I love the kids, and I saw what they had to go through in North Philly, not having enough of anything, and definitely not having enough recess at all, which helps balance, you know, the mind-body
connection. You know, Ethel, if you can ask your question, that'd be good.
No, I'm just saying, why don't they utilize the media more if the kids are on the electronic media all day? Utilize it in the schools more and just admit that that's what's happening and use it to teach the children if that's what they like.
Okay, fair enough. Diane Ravitch, your thoughts?
Well, you know, there are some schools that do, but I think that kids also need to learn to read. They need to learn to use their hands, and they need to kind of, in some way, back off from the blinking screens and learn to be human beings without just sitting and being passively entertained, or even just engaging with blinking screens. That itself is kind of a limitation of the time we live in. Of course, you have to learn to navigate those things, but don't let them take over your life.
I'm looking at something that was in the New York Times. We're almost out of time here, but this is about a Texas school board, I'm quoting here, going in a different direction, holding hearings on changes to its social studies curriculum
right.
that would portray conservatives in a more positive light, emphasize the role of Christianity in American
right.
history, and include Republican political philosophies in textbooks.
Right. I posted a blog about that yesterday on the Daily Beast.
I figured.
I wrote a book in 2003 called The Language Police about this whole textbook adoption process in Texas and California and 20 other states. The whole process is ridiculous. The state should not be choosing textbooks. This is why they have the power in these, particularly Texas, because it's so big, in California, to tell textbook publishers to change this line, drop this character, add that character. They should just abolish the whole textbook adoption process and let schools and teachers choose the books and the whatever electronic mm-hmm. media they think are right for their classroom. This is an infringement of academic freedom, and it also opens the door to all kinds of outrageous extremism from all directions, and that's what the language police was about, was getting rid of that whole ridiculous process.
So we, in 30 seconds or less, are we going to be able to improve our schools in this country?
We're not on track to improving them. We're on track to maintaining the basic guidelines of No Child Left Behind, testing kids once a year in reading and math, and using those tests to decide which schools should be closed. I think it's the wrong direction. I think we're on the wrong track. We need a much more sweeping and much more fundamental change in education to raise our truly raise our sights as well as our standards.
Well, Diane Ravitch, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, giving us a lot to talk about and think about as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a professor of education at New York University, and her book, The Death and Life of the Great American School System, How Testing and Choice Are Undermining Education, it's just been published. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out more about the program. Leave us an email. Join us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia and WHYY.org, member-supported public media.